Okay. If Eli can ask, nobody sit in that corner. No one sit in that corner, including you, man. Right? You're in that corner, you're not here. Come. Okay.
That's on the recording. Okay.
So
I've been asked to speak for a few minutes about the question of kitniyot on Pesach. Those people who are interested, I'll be happy to give you a handout that was printed last year, I think. Maybe 2 years ago, I forget. On the Svarim blog, about the question of whether coffee and marijuana are kitniyot. But we'll now I have your attention. Okay? Right? So people are saying, what? I can't use it on Pesach? Anyway, what? One second, but I'll be happy to give you that hand. I didn't print it up here, but I'll but it's a fun piece. Anyway, but first, a little background about kitniyot. If this is something that people say, we only wish we could be Sfardim, so that way we could eat rice.
Right. Enjoy a
month of slichot. Right. They get into this argument, month of slichot. Right, yay, right. And then, basar chalak, and the things along those lines. Bet Yosei, kumrot about bishul akum, all sorts of things along those lines. But it's a... We'll talk more about it. But first, I just want to remind everybody, right, that we're talking about a staple food. Okay, this isn't with regard to kitniyot, but this is, just to keep things in perspective. I was in Shlichut in Chicago, so they told me the following story that when the Dunkin' Donuts, when they had the first Dunkin' Donuts in Chicago that got Ashkacha. Run by Pakistanis, Bangladesh, and whoever people who have that franchise. So they went through the whole thing with kashrut. Fine. They opened it up in November, and it was doing booming business, right? Everything was great. And then 1 week in the end of March, right? The Pesach was early that year, one in the week of March. Suddenly, nobody from the community shows up. Right? They've forgotten to inform the franchise owners about the fact that that Pesach was coming. So they said, okay, there was a day, nobody showed up, fine. Next day, nobody showed up. Third day, nobody showed up. So they called up the Rabbanim. They were sure that they had done something to insult the community. Right? And nobody was coming to the thing. And they said, don't worry. Wait another 5 days. We'll more than make up for it. And sure enough, a few years later, right? I'm sure, I'm just talking about what happened in Chicago, but I'm sure this happens just about everywhere else. Right? So after we turned the kitchen back over and everything was all chametz back in the house after Pesach, etc., right? And I said, okay, let's go get some bagels from Dunkin' Donuts. It was 1 a.m. And there was literally a line twice around the block, right, in the drive-in window, right, for the Dunkin' Donuts. And I said, forget it, I'll wait till the morning. It's not a big deal. We go a little bit nuts about this, there are deep psychological issues that are at the fore here, that we get so worked up that suddenly, to say, you can eat rice or you can't eat rice, right, for a week. Right, Kilu, if we were to serve rice today in the Cheder Ochel, there would be lines around the block waiting for the rice. But suddenly, because you said for a week you can't have rice, right? Then suddenly, this is the worst deprivation in the world. and that we have to go so upset, right? Kitniot is becomes a real, whipping boy, you know, for people in terms of minhagim and the how terrible chumrot are, etc. I don't think it's such a terrible thing. But first, let's talk about where it comes from, where the yisur is, what are the limitations of the yisur, and if there is such a concept, and see what it goes from there. So just a little background, right? The makorot in front of you, the first three makorot. What kitniot is not? Kitniot is not chametz. Right? The pasuk says, and that is pretty clear. The pasuk says the following: Lo tochal olav chametz shivat yamim, tochal olav matzot lechem oni. Right, that you will not eat chametz for 7 days. Rather, you will eat the matzah. Right, the bread of affliction, because you left quickly, etc. We all know that. So now, this connection, though, between chametz and matzah is a very important one, halachically. Namely, that in order for something to be matzah, it has to have the potential to be chametz. Whereas if you use a flour, which, if left to ferment, would not become chametz, then it cannot be used for matzah. It has to be something that has the potential to become chametz, and that the Mishnah says here in the second source. The Mishnah is quite explicit. These are the five grains which you can make matzah from and biyotze, right? Wheat, barley, spelt, rye, and oats. Okay, now, there's another issue, by the way, whether what we consider in terms of these species is indeed halachically what those species are. It's another question, which is, other people who, for example, there are, I don't know the exact number, but in excess of 40 species, known species, of wheat itself. So which wheat are we talking about exactly, right? And they vary. They don't necessarily, is the definition of the species that's used by Linnaeus, etc., that can cross breeding and all of that, is that the halachic definition? Those are all good questions, but we'll assume for the moment that what we call these grains are their grains. So the Gemara says the following, after quoting this Mishnah, the Gemara says, Madnitin delo kerebi yochanan menuri. Our Mishnah, which quoted these five different grains, is not like the opinion of Shita of Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. Da amar orez min daganhu v'chayavin al chimutzo karet. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri was of the opinion that rice is, assuming that orez is rice, that rice is a grain. In fact, there's forget about the fact that rice is a grain, and if you allowed it to ferment, it would become chametz. And this is the Gemara brings a direct quote for the Tashama Detanya Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri Orez min daganu v'chayavin al chimutzo karet v'adam yotze bo yedei chavotel b'pesach. But according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, if you had rice, you allowed it to become chametz, it would be like any other chametz that you know in terms of all of the halachic prohibitions that are involved with it, and at the same time you can make rice matzah. Right? If you were to be careful and not to allow it to reach the point of chametz, 18 minutes, etc. This, in other words, for Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, rice is a grain. So you could say that perhaps the minhag of kitniot developed because even though we don't paskin like Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, matnitin delo k'Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, perhaps we are choshesh for Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. Right? Perhaps, the Ashkenazim want, since it's on the books as a known and accepted shita of the Tanaim, so we won't make rice matzo because we're not going to use it for mitzvah aseh, but to prevent perhaps an Isser de Rabbanan, to prevent a possible Isser of Chametz according to some shita, so we're going to stay away from rice
entirely. That would be a reasonable thing to say. However, that doesn't seem to be the case, because the Gemara, in our perek, in the 10th perek, the Gemara says, with regard to a different issue entirely, with regard to the question of your Seder plate, right? You know that you have on your Seder plate, you have your, what do you have on your Seder plate?
Egg.
Right? What?
Egg.
You have your egg? Okay.
Shank bone.
Your shank bone? What else?
Maror,
charoset, matzah, etc. Maybe tonight in the Haggadah Shir, I'm going to talk a little bit about where the order of the Ka'ara and different opinions of how to set up your Ka'ara comes up and how it ties us into Kabbalah and things along those lines. But the Gemara talks about the fact that you don't have to have an egg and a shank bone. Believe it or not, then Chazal did not have an egg and a shank bone. Right? They probably didn't even know what a shank bone is. With that, they would join most of the population of the world. What? My shnei tavshilid. But the Gemara does say that you're supposed to have two cooked items on your ka'ara. Right? That minhag is an ancient one. One is zecher le korban Pesach, and one is zecher le korban chagigah. Those are the two korbanot that people would eat at their seder at the Beit HaMikdash. Right, so we unfortunately have not been doing that for the last couple of thousand years. Maybe this year there's still time, but so we have a zecher and a ka'ara, and there are two cooked items. What are those two cooked items? Amar Rav Huna, silka va'aruza. So Rav Huna, maybe because he, like Joe Benin was a vegan. Right? I don't know. So he didn't have shank bones and eggs. He had exactly when that minhag starts, that's a later minhag. He had beets and rice. That was his, I wouldn't mind having been in Rav Huna's Haggadah, a Seder, right? Been a guest there for the Torah. But I don't know if I necessarily would have gone for the cuisine. Rava, right? Because he had a minhag. Rava, have a mehader asilka aruza hoil v'nafik mipumed Rav Huna. Two generations later, Rava made sure that on his ka'ara he had also had beets and rice, because since Rav Huna had it on his ka'ara, had to be a good thing. Okay, so that was became a minhag, but that minhag did not continue. Amar of Ashi shma mina de Rav Huna. Let the chayish lahad Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. Here you have Rav Ashi who says, right, quite explicitly and categorically, that because you see what Rav Huna had on his Seder plate, you can deduce from that that there is absolutely no reason in the world to be concerned with the shita of Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri is rejected. Rice is perfectly fine. There is no question of chametz at all. That is the case. Now, that leads us basically to the end of the Talmudic period. Right? Everybody's happy. Right? There is no issur of kidneyot. Right? There are no troubles in the world because people can eat rice on Pesach. However, things change. Yes.
But I know that he's allowed to have rice on the Seder plate, but it could just be cooked rice. Are we allowed to have wheat germ on Pesach?
No, you cannot. Well, again, here's the story. I don't know what wheat germ is. Okay?
And roasted wheat grain.
What?
Roasted wheat
grain. Roasted, I don't know if that is what wheat germ is.
It's the whole.
Technically speaking, without getting into it, you can have roasted grain. Right? In other words, if you have grain, which you ascertain with 100% surety, that no moisture did not come into contact with moisture, and it was roasted, right? You are allowed to eat that on Pesach. That in the halachic and in the Gemara terminology, and many of you have already seen this Gemara, is called what?
Klayot.
Okay, kali, right? That roasted grain, right? It also was found first where? It's a pasuk actually. right, with regard to the Korban HaOmer and the Isra of Chadash before the Korban HaOmer. V'lechem v'kali v'charmel lo tochlu. You're not allowed to eat bread or roasted grain or raw grain, right, until you bring the Korban HaOmer on the second day of Pesach. Okay, so, but it's Pesach, it's Chametz, right? What are you talking about? So, Kali, Lechem is presumably Matzah, right? But, what's Kali? So that's roasted grain. So roasted grain is permissible, but, so it could be that he roasted the rice. Okay, but, you know, if you've ever had roasted rice, right, you know that that's what we call burnt rice. What? Oh, it could be...
Rice Krispies.
No, but they use liquid in Rice Krispies. I believe so.
Right.
But I'm not 100% sure. It could be Rice Krispies. But there's no indication. No indication here.
You go to like...
It'd be an interesting question, but I don't think that that's what was under Rav Huda's thing. I think Rav Huda just put it into the pot, added the water, and boiled. Okay. So now, what? Or Mrs. Huna did that. One or the other.
They didn't have like an industrial...
What?
They
didn't have like a slumber power. Right, they did not have a slumber power. Okay. So, back to the case. So, where does this minhag of kitniyot arise? And the truth is, the answer is, anyone know the answer?
We don't know.
What do we know? And now we are going, I'm taking a piece, this is a piece that's quoting a, or actually summarizing a piece of the, if we want to look at it inside, it's really not the smack, the Sefer Mitzvot Katan, which is a piece from the 13th century, but is a commentary of Rabbeinu Peretz, also the 13th century, on that. But this, so we're dealing with here a quotation from the 13th century. Okay? 1200s, and we have the following. Al kitniyot kigon pulim v'adashim, with regard to legumes. Right? There's certain, you ever notice that there's certain words that only come up in Judaism? Right? Shank bones, legumes. Who talks about legumes? Anyway, al kidiyot kigon pulim adashim yesh doagim isur laochlam bepesach. Guys. There are those people who have the minhag not to eat them on Pesach with regard to beans and lentils. V'chein harav Shmuel meivra, right? And so was the custom of Shmuel Meivra. Aval HaRabbeinu Yechiel. Okay? Rabbeinu Yechiel, who lived in Paris. Rabbeinu Yechiel mi Paris, of the, in the mid 13th century. And he was most famous for the great debate in the year 1242 to 1244. That's how great a debate it was. It went for 3 years. With regard to defending the Talmud, he lost because it was kind of a he didn't really stand a chance, kind of rigged. And as a result, in the center of Paris today, in the site of the municipality building, they burnt many wagon loads of Sfarim, and as a result, much was lost to Yahadut forever. But however, he v'shar gdolim hayu nohagim behen heter. He was mekel, right? So Rabbeinu Yechiel mi Paris, he's one of the Baalei Tosfot, mid 13th century. He tried to buck the trend and said that kitniyot were mutar on Pesach. However, kashem me'od hadavar lahatir. With all due respect, the Sefer Mitzvot Katan says, to Rabbeinu Yechiel mi Paris and Shar Gedolim, it is very difficult to roll back this Isur, this Minhag, and to make it Mutar, and he gives two reasons. One, that if you might recall from the beginning of the year, from the fourth parak, Kevin Sha'acherim Nahagu Behem Isur. One is a case because it's become a Minhag, and Minhagim have halachic weight. That's number one. Number two, davar shenohagim haolam isur mimei chachamim kadmonim. Right? This is not just a fly-by-night type of minhag. This is a minhag that has already been grounded in practice from Yemei Chachim, Chachamim Kadbonim, from the days of early sages. How far back that means, I don't know. In other words, we're talking right now in the mid-13th century. And he's saying that this goes back, is an ancient custom that he doesn't even know the source for. And I'm going to see now in a moment why, how I know that he doesn't have the source. Right? So it means that it's a minhag that has lost its trace. So we're talking about a minhag of, you know, that goes back 150, 200 years at least. Right? That people, there's no, if you've already lost the trace, and no one can even say, oh, this is why it is, it's around, that means that it's a very ancient minhag. In fact, if there, if you are interested, there, I mean, these type of articles come up every now and then. So, about 15 years ago, Professor Tashima Zatzal put together one of the leading researchers in Ashkenazic custom, as in general, in terms of Talmudic research. So he put together an article. He claims it goes back to Eretz Yisrael of the second, third century, right? Going back and dealing with an isur of not eating kidney for a completely different reason on all the Shalosh Regalim, and then sort of transformed itself. But it's a very long minhag, very ancient minhag, going back. V'nireh, so now the smart says, okay, it's an ancient minhag, but why do they do it? Nireh shelo nagu bo isur mishum chimutz, delo tawin shibizeh. So it's not because anybody thinks that it actually becomes chametz, because this, no, that's something that nobody would make a mistake about. The tinokot shel beit rabban yodin oto. Right? Everybody knows. Right? The children in school. Everybody knows that the halacha is not like Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. Nobody would make such a mistake. Skip a line. El asrum mishum didagan maaseh kedera v'kitnit maaseh kedera gzeira ha'atuha. Right? Perhaps these are reasons that you've probably heard before. Perhaps you're going to make a mistake between some kind of porridge, let's say an oatmeal of some kind, and some kind of rice cereal. You know, farina and rice cereal, they sort of look close enough. You're going to make that kind of mistake. Or, gam pa'amim tfuam urevet bahem v'yefshar l'varo yafeh. Right? Or another time, simply because, and there are those who claim that the minhag became started out historically when they started rotating crops more, and as a result, one year you'd plant wheat, the next year you would plant legumes. Right? You couldn't plant corn because they hadn't discovered the New World yet, but you'd plant something along those lines, and things would sprout from the previous year. Whenever you harvest something, so you don't get it 100%. Wheat kernels fall on the ground. They germinate and sprout the following year. So when you harvest your bean crop, you have wheat mixed in. Okay, so there are those. So this idea was already found in as a possible rationale here in the Haggadot Maimonides in the 13th century. So there are those who say historically they can trace that practice in Europe to like the 11th century or so, and that's maybe when the minhag began. But here, what I want to stress is that this is conjecture. It's not conjecture for me and for you. It's conjecture already in the time of the 13th century. They've had the minhag for decades, maybe even centuries, and the rationale for the original minhag has been lost. And now he's giving possible rationales that go on. It's a very ancient minhag. And therefore the Smak says this is something that should be respected. Now it's a, just because it's a, we're not 100% sure why we're doing it, there might be good reasons. And with all due respect to Rabbeinu Yechiel Paris and the Gedolei at Balei Tosfot, it's not something that should be tampered with. The Beit Yosef, after a bit of a discussion, is less impressed by this. Beit Yosef, I've just quoted one line here, number 5. V'let techash dvarim halalu. Right? Nobody, is concerned about these things. Right? The Beit Yosef says, right? Except for Zulati Ashkenazim, just the Ashkenazim. You can't you know, from the Beit Yosef's perspective, you can't diss people any more than that, right? Just the Ashkenazim worry about it, nobody else, right? And I see that all the Sephardim are smiling, and the Ashkenazim are not so sanguine about it. But okay, the that is the, but that seems to be the idea. In other words, if we have a source, we don't have a clear-cut rationale. And that's very important to keep in mind, because I'll just quote one second, just to show you maybe two sides of how seriously this is dealt with. The Maharil, so now we've jumped to the 14th century. And the Maharil says the following. It says, Kitniot, end of 14th, the beginning of 15th. Kitniot kol minehem amar barel v'rabbeinu shmuel de gazrina shalol v'ashlan b'pesach af api shalom achmitzim kim chameshet aminim. Right? So we have this gzeirah not to cook them on Pesach even though they can't become chametz. Bold print. Al yomar adam kevan she'in asur midaraita ein lachush. First, it shouldn't say, well, let's face it, Rabbi, it's not going to be a problem of Doraita, so why should I care? Dechol de gazru rabbanan ha'over alav chayav mita va'over alo tasur min adavar asher yarucha. Right, so if you violated rabbanan, you're chayav mita, he says, because that goes to the heart of the system, that the rabbanim have the authority. Right? You can't also say that this was some kind of mistaken minhag. Why not? Davar shepashut isuro uval hatiro mikoach minhag sham yisacher pidov reisheker. This is something where if you have and something which has become so widespread, the minhag is firmly, firmly rooted, and let those people who speak falsehood, let their mouths be sealed. Yeah. Right? Chacham, and even if you want to tie it to some kind of chacham, right? So he calls that sheker diber hanavi hahu. Right, so that prophet, that chacham, is speaking falsehood. Well, this is an idea that becomes very, very firmly rooted. And here I have to tell you, this is as good an example as any other for a living, breathing Judaism, if you will. In other words, people don't, in my opinion, don't have a healthy respect for minhagim. Right? Minhagim, right, are not just the question of, well, which are wonderful minhagim in themselves. What are the traditional dishes that your mother, grandmother, etc., will be serving at the Seder? Right? And everybody has those minhagim that are passed on, and everybody's, you know, the hamantash recipe that was someone's great grandmother's and is now passed on. Yada yada yada. Those are wonderful things. Don't get me wrong. That's part of it too. These type of minhagim are also part of it. This is what allows the religion to be a living organism, as opposed to merely being a set of very dry halachot, which are packed in books and people pull them off the shelf. Okay. Now the fact is that what we're going to see here in the next few minutes, and I'm going to try to keep it briefly, is something where the minhag has changed itself, and sometimes people are going to try to fight that trend to if it's going in one direction or another. Sometimes people are successful, some people are not. But the very fact that the minhag is changing, even to this day, right? Kitniot is something which is constantly evolving as new food products come onto market. And the question, like I said, when I opened up the discussion, coffee and marijuana, right? So that is, right, that's something that doesn't need to be discussed necessarily. But the fact that it is being discussed, right, or on a more less exciting level,
quinoa,
right? Chocolate. Why isn't chocolate a a problem of kidney out.
Okay.
Okay, that could very well be. Why aren't potatoes a problem of kidney out? Why? How is it that corn became problematic? Okay. You know, since corn, as I said before, is a New World plant, exactly when does that become a problem? So here, I'd like to take a look at two, there, you know, this could easily be, this is a type of shit that's really wonderful in terms of seeing development of issues. I want to take a look at one approach here, now skip to number 9. The this is a tshuva from 1966. Tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein. I grew up, right, with Planters peanut oil having an okay hashkacha for Pesach, for Passover use. Okay, I remember it very, very clearly. You can't find that anymore. Okay, and the question was posed to Rav Moshe, the peanut oil already had the hashkacha. Okay? And Rav Moshe was approached by someone, this Rav Yaakov Goldman, I don't know who he is, that the with regard to whether we have to be concerned about kidney out with regard to peanuts. And this is Rav Moshe's tshuva. Hine b'davar ha-peanut shekatavti shebarbe mekomot achlu otam bepesach uchvod torato tama b'tam ha-davar, right, that the, how could it be that people ate peanuts on Pesach? And you, right, you're concerned about that. Because you heard people can make, you know, someone, this Rav Goldman must have read the biography of George Washington Carver. Okay? And found out that there are, you know, 243 uses for the peanut. Okay? And you can make peanut flour. Right, right. All, anybody who's not from North America doesn't know what I'm talking about. Right? You can make, you know, you can make peanut flour and, you know,
peanut flour and chocolate cans.
Okay.
Everywhere.
Thank you. And you can that you can and it's planted like other legumes are planted. So then he says the following. Abal yedak v'teratos. So this is Rav Moshe's tshuva. He says, okay, I understand your concern, but now understand why your concern is unfounded. She'ein ze inyan klal. She'kol ha'dvarim ha'osim mehem kemach nasru min ha'gadzeh. Because nothing, it's not true that everything that was, that can be made into flour is forbidden. De'ein lecha davar ha'osim memenu kemach ketapuchei adama. Right? Potato flour is something which is very common, very ubiquitous. Lorak b'minazo, not only, you know, say that it's, you know, this God-forsaken place called America, right? That this is where it's been done, and, you know, they're all apikarsim here anyway also. Elagam b'Europe b'mkomotenu, v'gam b'dorot ha'kodmim, u'me'olam lo chashu le'isur zeh. Right? Nobody ever was concerned about potatoes. Right? And you can make potato flour. People made potato flour. It's not a problem. So you see that the ability to make flour out of something doesn't turn it into kidney out. There were some achronim, by the way, who were choshesh for potatoes. What they ate on Pesach, I don't know. Okay? But that, what? They ate a lot of matzah. V'lachein ein lanu b'davar elamash mefurash. No, this is a very important line. The bold print here in number 9. V'chein ein lanu b'davar el mashi mufurash nahagu le'asor v'chein mashi yadua mufursam. The only thing that is usur is that which has become usur, right, and is known. V'gam yesh liten tam. Didin mashi nesar b'minhag ha'ein zed davar ha'nesar b'kibbutz chachamim. A minhag is by definition not something necessarily which a group of, you know, the elders of Zion get together. And after, you know, this is part of their agenda. World domination, right? Undermining the banking system, right? This is all on the tape. And then, you know, adding to the kidney out list, right? Those are the, that's not that, by the way, from a Jewish housewife's perspective, that's not necessarily the order of evil either, right? Okay? So, but that's not how the minhag happens. Right? That's not what happens. But rather, you know what it happens? It's a question of popular practice. Popular practice over time determines what is considered kitniyot and what isn't considered kitniyot. Because there is no reason, no logical reason to explain why corn is kitniyot and potatoes are not. No logical reason to explain why we're choshesh for soybeans, okay, but not, soybeans, but not for peanuts at the time in 1966. Okay? 45 years later, right? Peanuts are considered kitniyot. You cannot find a... So there are people going, ugh. But that is part of the process. Now, it doesn't mean necessarily, by the way, that things can't go in the other direction at some point. Okay? But the but you cannot find a hashgacha that would say that it's that the lo chashash kitniyot without a in Israel. How many people here are going to be here over Pesach?
It's going to be so much fun.
Okay. Okay. So things are much better in this country than they were on many levels. But things are much better in this country when it comes to labeling of products than they were, let's say, 15, 20 years ago even. Right? Now, virtually anything, you can see the labels that it says, lo chashash kitniyot or lo ochlei kitniyot. The only thing is that different companies have a different system. Some of the companies will assume that it's without kitniyot unless specifically mentioned that it has kitniyot, and some companies assume it has kitniyot unless it specifically says that it doesn't have kitniyot. So you have to know which company is which.
Or just check.
Right? What?
Or just check the ingredients.
No, you can't always check the ingredients. However, according to many poskim, kitniyot are batel berov also. But that's that's something which people don't like to talk about. Yeah.
How did the practice ever change unless you just decided to go ahead and break the current minhag?
Okay, things move in. Look. This is going to lead us to a larger discussion, which I don't want to get into the discussion. I'm just going to throw out something from the which didn't come up, at least not when I was around, during the Yom Iyun on Sunday. Okay? But when people are... Well, Yom Iyun on Sunday, though, that was 3 days ago. Right, what did they talk about? Right, women's issues, right? So, just to give you an example about how things change and people don't even sense that they change. But they really do change. There's a lot of the discussion in the panel that was right where I'm standing right now, right, centered upon the question of women learning Gemara. Right? That was sort of like a foundation for a lot of the discussion that happened, right, and that changes and that happened. And it was even raised, people said, someone asked, why is it such a big deal about women learning Gemara, per se? Why is that such a focal point, right? So for me, several things. First of all, just that you should be able to sense from that conversation. Here it is, the year, Tafshin Ayin Aleph of 2011, that, many people here in this room take it for granted that, of course, women should be able to learn Gemara, which was anything but the case, 30 years ago or so. Right? To the extent that Rav Soloveitchik made it his business, right, when the inaugural Gemara Shir at Stern College, that he would give it, and he would be photographed giving it, right? Because he didn't want, I think the year was 1975 or 76, because he did not want to have the situation that after, he left the scene, and he was already in his 70s, that people would say that he wasn't really in support of women learning Gemara. Okay, one second. But that's not what I want to talk about. Women learning Gemara is the... But so today, there's still an argument about women learning Gemara. But that is the, like, the least important part of the discussion. Why? Because if you went back now, not 30 years, 40 years, to historically speaking, but you went back 130 years, okay? 140 years, certainly. So how many Orthodox women were receiving a formal Jewish education?
Zero.
Okay? Zero. In other words, people were getting, Orthodox women were getting a home, home educated. They were always, you know, the famous, you know, Yentl Yeshiva buffer type of thing, right? And you can find individual women throughout Jewish history who were learned. Sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less, but there wasn't a formal educational program for them. Period. Okay. And if you and when you read Rishonim all the time, you see when talking about illiteracy, it's always mentions women. It's a given. Women are illiterate, etc. Today, what percentage of Orthodox Jewish women receive a formal education?
100%.
100%. And that happened mainly because of the pioneering efforts of the Beis Yaakov system. You know, you hear so-called about the pioneering efforts of the Beis Yaakov system. Right? That sounds sort of like an oxymoron, right? But, right, if it hadn't been, right, for Sarah Schneerson and the support that she received from the Chafetz Chaim, right? So that's what that broke the ground. Now, the question of, well, what should women learn? Should they learn Torah Shebaal Peh? Should they not learn Torah Shebaal Peh? How do you define Torah Shebaal Peh? It's okay to learn Rashi when he quotes a Gemara, but it's not allowed to learn the Gemara, or it is okay to learn the Gemara, etc. All of these questions are secondary. Right? And that's just an example of how things change, and you would never even think that if I went back 150 years ago, right, the world was a completely different world in that regard. So the same thing holds true here, right? In other words, if you were to things that sometimes it goes, right, this is more a question of different historical periods. Right now, as you all probably are aware, the tides are going l'chumrah, right? Common practice is moving, for the most part, right? A little bit more machmir than was accepted 30 years ago, 40 years ago, etc., in different things. Right? But that's a counter movement, to a certain extent, that, because for the previous 50 years or so, the movement was in the other direction. Right? Or 100 years. Things going lakula. So there's action, there's reaction in terms of these things. Here, in terms of kidneyot, so this is something which has moved in a different direction. I'll just mention something, you know, Raviol Ben-Nun, a few years ago, put out an article in which he said that based on the rationale here, what's the most famous rationale for kidneyot being asur?
The mill where they grinded the
what?
Things, there'd be cross-contamination.
Cross-contamination, or people making making mistakes in terms of the products and the like, right? So he said, listen, based on that rationale, if I were to take that rationale, then all of the kosher for Passover products that, you know, that have come out lately, you know, kosher for Passover brownies, right, kosher for Passover, bagels, you know, cereal, etc. Right, coffee cakes. Whatever you want, you know, every year there's another, you know, dozen or so on the shelves. Right? How could we possibly live without, you know, Cheerios? They don't call it Cheerios; they call it, you know, Matzah-os or whatever they call it. Right? So, you know, and so they sell, you know, all these things. So he says those should become usher because of kidneyot. But those you can really confuse, right? If you a lot of times you can't, like, when, no, that's not always true. If you take a lot of the packaged goods, right? The let's say Elite or Strauss put out their coffee cakes, right? And you one with and they're shahako, they're potato flour based, right? And you
take those and you take it next to their regular coffee cake, it's not that different. It really isn't that different. And they're both pretty good. What?
Once you taste it, then you know.
No, even if you taste it, but it certainly doesn't look different. And if you taste it during Pesach, you know, you really don't feel like you're really missing out that much. Because you know what their other product tastes like. But anyway, the point though is that, so that might be of a more concern. That, in that regard, would be much more makil than people were in previous generations, to a certain extent. When it comes to defining what kidneyot are, we're machmir. But this is the idea. There's a lot of times things are determined by practice. Things change. That doesn't mean that just because someone comes right now, for example, I won't say which family, but I know a prominent rabbinic family, right, where there's a discussion about quinoa, or quinoa, how is it pronounced?
Quinoa.
Ah! Anyway, it sounds like something, Kung Fu Panda. Anyway, I don't know, what?
Quinoa!
Anyway, the point though is that I know. Anyway, the point though is there's a discussion as to whether quinoa is kidneyot or not, right? Right now, if you take a look at most guides, they will tell you quinoa is not considered to be kidneyot.
Yeah.
Okay, but it should be bought with a reliable hashgacha to make sure. Apparently, it can have grain products occasionally mixed in, so that's not reliable hashgacha. But whether it'll be considered to be kidney out in 15 years, I don't know. I'll give you another example. Canola oil. Canola oil is made out of, anyone know?
Rapeseed.
Okay? They changed it from rapeseed to canola because they realized that rapeseed doesn't sell as well. Okay? Similar marketing is happened with, anyone want to guess? With the kiwi. Okay? Right? Yeah, kiwi. Was what? Yeah, well, I forget the original name, but the kiwi had like this. You remember the name? What? Oh, I'm trying to remember what the kiwi was. Anyway, it had this really terrible name. Couldn't be marketed. They looked at it. They said it looks like the kiwi bird, right? Comes to New Zealand, and we'll call it kiwis. And voila, you know, did wonderful things, right?
It was like.
Well, at least it's fine. Anyway, canola. Why am I mentioning canola oil? Right, the oil of the rapeseed plant, right? The seed is inedible. The only way that you can use the seed is to make oil out of it, and it's a dry process. No liquid comes into it doesn't come into contact with liquid in the process. Right, so it's an impossibility for any of the rationales for it to be kidney out to be considered kidney out, and therefore there is a machloket to this day. Originally, this machloket goes back a long time, about over 100 years. There are those who say that it was usher even then. Most practice was to accept it. It wasn't all that popular when it became more popular, right? Because people considered it to be healthier than corn oil and things along those lines. So then, this is going back only about 20 years or so. 20 years ago, I remember everybody was using canola oil. Right? I shouldn't say everybody. You know, I don't know what was going on in certain neighborhoods in Yerushalayim and the like. But for the most part, it was considered not to be kidneyot. Today, I think the most people, you'll see in Israel, the Hashgachat says, it has lifta, which is the same thing as rapeseed oil, and that is a machloket. There are those who are makil, and there's a machmir. Personally, I am makil. I think Rabbi Ebner is machmir. I'm not sure about, you can ask him per se, but different people are makil or machmir. It's sort of moving. It's what peanut oil was 40 years ago. Okay? These things change, and we'll see what the jury is out in terms of any particular item. Yeah.
So I understand for things like lentils and beans, that's an ancient minhag, extending back maybe 1,000 years or more.
Right.
But for things like canola and or peanuts, these are just things that in the last decades have been indiscriminately labeled as kidney oat or otherwise. just based for absolutely no reason. Like, even if there was a reason for the beans and lentils, those reasons certainly don't apply to these things today. So what's the point of just these?
Okay.
It's machmir for the sake of being machmir.
No, it's not being machmir for the sake of machmir. And again, I agree with your description, with the exception of one word, which you, I was listening to you very carefully, the exception of the word, indiscriminate. But here, I mean, the practice isn't indiscriminate. Here it's a question of, as I said, what becomes accepted within the context. Here, you're right. You have to differentiate between what is the source of the minhag, okay, what's the source of the minhag, and what is the practice of the minhag. So the source of the minhag, right, indeed, may not apply anymore, right? Forget about the canola oil or peanut oil. We go straight to corn. Okay? And we'll pretend for the moment for us that corn was something which existed. Okay? Or rice for that matter. If you have, you know, in modern farming practices, right? And certainly in modern preparation practices, right? You're not going to find any wheat kernels mixed in. Right, you've dealt with the problem of it. Right, things are clearly labeled. Right, we deal with this in other areas of halacha as well, in terms of things that are mutter. Right, that all you have to do to make avoid marit ayin, make sure that you know nobody is assuming that you have creamer, you know, with your coffee after a fleishik meal. So you put the box where it's rice milk or something along those lines. Right, obviously not a Pesach. Okay, another time. But the so you can avoid the root cause of the problem. However, that doesn't mean that the minhag doesn't have life in of itself. Here, there are a lot of other things that that go on. You know, how many people here come from families that do not eat gebruchs? How many people know what gebruchs means? Right? Okay. Gebruchs means what in Hebrew is called shruya. Making matzah balls, using matzah meals. Now there is a minhag that developed in Hungarian circles. Okay, that stopped the that said that we have to be concerned with using matzah as matzah meal and the like, because maybe there's a unbaked area in that matzah, and it becomes chavit. Fine.
Never eaten matzah before.
Now, one second. Hold on. And there's another minhag that allows for the use of these products on the eighth day of Pesach, because it's not really chavit. It's obviously what it says. So different minhagim. Growing up, you know, about 40 years ago, I remember very clearly that very few products on the market were concerned about gebruchs shruya. Right? Anything kosher for Passover product that you would buy, right? It had matzah meal in it, etc. All the cake mixes, etc. Right? All of these things had it. No questions attached to it. Right, and I had some friends and family. Like my aunt married a Hungarian, and so she had to change all of her recipes that she had gotten from we come from more Polish Lipish stock on my mother's side, and she had to change all the recipes because now she couldn't use matzah meal and everything. She had to use everything was potato flour. Okay, so fine. Today, right? If you go on virtually anything that you bought, I shouldn't say virtually anything, I'd say it's at least 50-50, maybe even more, you'll see that baked goods have shahakol attached to them. Because they want to sell it to that segment of the market that are concerned with that. Where does that come from? Right? Okay, there's a concern, etc. People, Pesach itself, right, is a crazy time. Okay, it's a crazy time. The way that people clean for Pesach is crazy. The way that people kosher their kitchen. And if you put down, you know, a chametz thing in a sealed container on a Pesach surface, and, you know, you see various housewives getting heart attacks, right, by watching that occur, right, in slow-mo. Right, where does this happen from? Why does that happen? Because it reflects a deeply rooted, and this is a very positive thing, a very deeply rooted sense of the importance of the holiday, the importance of the minhagim. Right, and you can, by the way, point to a lot of other areas of halakha where this is the case as well. This is basically a positive thing. The fact that as a result, you know, I think here, speaking maybe a little bit out of the halakhic box, more on a sociological level, if it was more than a week, I don't think that people would go so crazy about it and expand this kidney onto that, etc., etc. They wouldn't. Right? But within the context of this, and I don't think that they're necessarily doing it consciously, but it's not so terrible, and it's reflecting a certain concern that people have. Okay? And that, by the way, that concern goes, as I said, ebbs and flows, and I think it's basically a positive thing. At times it's going to create a little bit, it's going to create things that seem to be a little illogical, and also, you know, might be somewhat burdensome, but only somewhat. Not too much, and I don't think we should get too worked up over it. Yeah.
A really, really good question. I'm just going to make it multiple choice. In terms of, like, kind of in response to what you were saying to Ruben.
None of the above.
You were saying you were kind of talking about, like, the people, they decide to stay upon themselves for a week, this and that. Does the popular practice boil down to the people, or is it post? Because if it boils down to the people, then I know I'll be eating kidney out this Pesach. So would you say that it boils down to the post-it or the people?
It boils down to the people, but not any individual person. In other words, okay, one second. So what would happen? One second. Could you have a situation? And this is something, let me ask you. It'll come down to a large extent what people want to do or do not want to do. Every few years, right, going back for the last 800 years, okay, this goes back to Rabbeinu Yechiel Miparis. You have different people coming out, and specifically with regard to kidneyot, trying to explain why kidneyot shouldn't be asur, or why kidneyot has gotten too far, etc., etc. Okay?
Yeah, they couldn't kill it. What,
and yet, right, kidneyot is just, you know, more massive than ever before. Right? Why is it? Not because of the. I really don't think it's because of the Rabbanim per se. I think that it's as I said, it's the Rabbanim who try to lead this effort. It's a question of what people really feel in terms of the holiday. So yes, if everyone in this room and other communities got up and said, we're going to do Hatarat Nedarim, and we are going to, theoretically, you're right. Okay. At the same time, I'll tell you historically, right? And go explain this one, right? Is there anyone here who's Moroccan?
Nobody's from Israel,
right? Moroccan Jewry accepted kidneyot upon themselves about 200 years ago. Okay. Sephardim as a whole do not have it. The Moroccans accepted the minhag upon themselves, right? They did. Okay? So, why did they do that? Right? So you could say, I don't understand. It was, why pick that? So, again, it's coming from a certain deeply rooted type of set of ideal. Which I think people would be happy to say, oh, we're choshesh for Riochet and Binuri and call it a day. But they realize they can't, so they look for other reasons. But it's coming. So could it go in the other direction? And are there people in Israel today who, especially now that you have it in Israel, a very large, even perhaps majority of the population of observant Jews are Sephardim, right? Certainly close to 50-50. And are there Ashkenazim who say that we should accept this minhag? Right, or turn our back on this minhag? Yes, there are Ashkenazim who want to do that. And will there be Ashkenazim, and are there individuals who do that? Yes, there are individuals who do that. Do I think that it's going to have any traction? Personally, I don't think it's going to have any real traction. Okay? Does it mean it's impossible? I don't mean it's impossible. We'd be happy to talk to you about it in 50 years in Yirtzeh Hashem to see how things have turned out. Right? But that's the way things go. But I also want to just add one other thing with regard to that, is that you have to, if you're going to play that type of game, then you know, what someone screamed out at the beginning of the shiur, you have to be consistent. In other words, it's one thing to say, I'm always going to change the minhag avot that I have if I feel that they are too machmir, right, to make life easier, right? But do you do it in the other direction, right? Change the minhag avot, which you feel, you know, let's say, if you come from a family, right, just as an example, I'm not saying that you should do it by any means, but let's say you were to come from a family where they wait 3 hours between meat and milk, right? Right? And you, after looking at the sources, would say, you know what? You know, this is, it should either be 1 hour, right?
Or
fine. Or 6 hours, right? The majority opinion over the last few hundred years has been towards the 6 hours. I'm going to change to 6 hours. Would you ever say such a thing?
No.
Right? So, then you have to notice, before you change your minhag avot, if you want to say, look, I wait 4 hours. That's my minhag avot. Okay? All right, but that gets to where that comes from. Fine. My brother changed it and became, he waits into the sixth. All right? I disagree with him on the principle. I like my minhag avot. I keep my minhag avot l'chumra. Right? I would never dream of starting to eat kidneyot. Right? I keep the makula as well. Right? And when there's a minhag ta'ut, so I know it's a minhag ta'ut too, and I make the appropriate adjustment. But be, accept your heritage. And sometimes heritages are a little burdensome. So that's not the end of the world. Okay? Just one other thing, and then I'll just take whatever questions, because I was supposed to finish, well, I was supposed to start earlier, and I was supposed to finish, I don't know how long ago. Just one issue. This comes up all the time. There is no issur. Right? Without getting the source, if you want to take a look at the source, it's here, it's number 10, the Trumat HaDeshen. There is no isur to have, according to any of the shittot, of bal yirah bal yimatzeh, no minhag of that isur of possessing kidney. In other words, you don't have to sell your kidney out. You don't have to for those people with that minhag, obviously, you don't have to sell kidney out. You don't have to get rid of it, etc. There's no problem in owning kidney out over the course of Pesach, even though it's not being used, obviously, if you have that minhag. A problem which comes up, and here there's a bit of a machloket, and I'll just mention the two approaches. The question is, and here in Israel it's you know, very common, but I think that, you know, people, when they're back wherever they're coming from, you know, especially after this year, this might be a problem for you even this year. And that is, can you, as, let's say, an Ashkenazic Jew, right, go to your Sephardic friends, right? They won't serve you rice, right? Because they respect your minhag, maybe more than you respect it. And they're not going to give you rice, right? But they're going to serve you food that was cooked in various pots that, you know, right before then had cooked rice. Right, you know, they're eating the meatballs and rice, and you're just eating the meatballs. Right, but the pot that they use for the meatballs is the same pot they use for the rice, right, a little bit before them. Right, so can you eat food that was cooked in kelim that had kidney oat in it? Okay, so here, the snippet that I brought here in number 11 is a piece from Rav Avadia Yosef. Which, okay, so you say, well, he's a Sephardi. But he says that there isn't any problem whatsoever for Ashkenazim. There are really three approaches. One approach is to say that only if it's been cooked in pots that are not ben yomo, that have been cooked within 24 hours, it's okay. The approach of Avadi Yosef, based on some pretty strong sources as well, is to say that even if it's cooked in pots that are ben yomo, within 24 hours it can be used.
Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach is quoted as saying that that it's Asur. I personally did not see him writing that inside, but I have to take a look at it. I have to see if that's the case. Personally, I think that I personally think that you could certainly be makel in this regard for various reasons. A lot of poskim are of the opinion that kitniot are batel berov, even though that's not the accepted custom, but certainly a very strong approach. And the extent that you're going to have tam of kitniot, and that's going to be a problem per se, that is tam at all a problem in terms of kitniot, is also not so clear. So person one is invited to a home where they are not where they eat kitniot on Pesach, so I don't think that it's a problem to eat non-kitniot products, but you have to make sure, of course, that you're not, that you know, there isn't some rice mixed in or the like. Yeah.
You said that you can own kitniot, like, you can't eat it, but can you use it for anything else? Like,
yes. In other words, you can, kitniot can is not asr behana. Right, chametz is asr b'hana. It's asr to derive any benefit from hana, from chametz. This is something that's not the topic of the shiur, but something, you know, very, very important, and it's very commonly overlooked. It is, you have to make sure that your pet foods, right, are chametz free. Right? You don't have to make sure they're kitniot free, but you have to make sure that they are chametz free.
Okay.
It is definitely asur to on the Doraita level to have use pet foods that are not chametz free. So, you know, dog foods, for example, there are certain brands that are and you have to do a little research to make sure that you don't have any chametz in whatever you're having, and you can't say that, of course, when you're talking about dog food, that's eino ra'uy la'achilat kelev.
If the pets, if in the chametz contract, the pets and the food are both sold under the contract,
would
that get rid of the...
I've never heard of that before. Okay, I have to look into that. So I don't know whether I would... I think it's easier just to get non-chametz food for your dog, right? You know... yeah,
well, you said that kind of as until as time goes on, you said like 100 years ago, people were more makeal about it.
Not always, by the way, not always. Certainly, I said 50 years ago, 40 years ago, you know, within my memory. But, you know, like I said, there were movements at times to say that potatoes themselves should be considered to be a kidney.
More makeal, did they actually say some things became not kidneyed, or was it just like the process of adding more things stopped?
I'm not familiar off the top of my head with the situation where things that had been considered on a widespread level to be kitniot, you know, were sort of removed from the list.
So it was just the process of adding more stuff.
That seems to be the case. With regard to kitniot, per se.
Right.
Yeah.
What was the reason for peanuts? Why has peanuts become kitniot?
Because it's a legume. And even though it basically became, you know, people looked at it and treated it as being a, even though it doesn't grow this quite, it grows underground and it doesn't grow the same, quite the same way as other legumes grow, but it became more. I mean, that, by the way, that process already began just for we'll finish by 11, but the just as an example, mustard, right, chardal. Right, so already this was included in at a later stage, an early later stage, but a later stage, and the Rishonim say, you know, it doesn't apply. It shouldn't have the rules of, because the original Isur seems to have been with regard not to legumes, but with regard to grains that aren't of the Chamesh Minin. Corn is a grain. Right, rice is a grain.
Right? These are not, they're not beans. They're not, these are things that are, you know, the, but because the plants grow in a similar way, so they were seem to have been included. Right? So, but mustard is the first example of the list growing at some point. And people say, well, even if you hold it, you should totally include mustard. Right? But can't stand in the way of progress. Yeah?
How do we know that rice was an grain from the past? The first source of things we have is about the Yad Hashem and the...
I'm sorry.
How do we know it was rice and grains that weren't in the five species that...
Because the question starts with Orez.
Where's the first question about Orez?
Well, the Gemara, that's in the Gemara, but the first is with regard to, in terms of the Ashkenazic custom, you're right, they're talking about pulim v'adashim, right? But those are things that they, actually this is something, you know, a little, in the year 2000, so the New York Times Magazine, right, asked 50 thinkers, or maybe it was 100, I think it was 50 thinkers, what they felt the most important advance of the previous millennia had been. Right. No, what's his name? So the one that was most interesting that I saw anyway, and the person who said it's going to... He's a popular author. A couple of his books have actually been turned into movies. Anyway, so he said the cultivation of the bean, which was which he documented and showed in the very beginning of the 11th century cultivation, and which because that allowed for a big leap in the protein consumption in Western Europe, which he claimed fueled all sorts of advances leading to the Renaissance, etc. Okay, so but this was a what?
Guns, germs, and steel.
No, it wasn't him. It'll come to me. Anyway, this is a. So the beans, when they're talking about beans, they're talking about something which was a staple crop. Okay, that's the point. Yeah.
Does batel berov apply for doctors?
Batel berov does not apply when it comes to real chametz, right? So it's not the bitul is not bitul berov. And even if you purchased it beforehand, etc., the bitul there would be less than shishim. So, like I said, you have to make sure that your dog foods have a they're not going to have a hashkafa necessarily, but they're going to. You can take a look at lists that are put out with the brands that are acceptable. You have to make sure they're acceptable brands, or you just feed them table scraps. Yeah.
Well, that's a check rice.
What?
Why do I have to check rice? That's not because it's
a because there might be bugs.
In America, the United States.
There are bugs in America too. I think that the Sephardic custom to carefully check for rice, not for rice, check their rice, comes from the fact that at times, right, there were other things that were put in, so that custom remains.
But it has no actual
significance. I don't know. You would have to check the packaging protocols of their various Umberto Eco, that's what it was. Anyway, the of the various they have to check the various packaging protocols of different things. Anything else? Questions? Yeah.
Let's say you have Sephardic relatives. Would you be able to eat kidneyot at their home?
If it is, this goes back to things that we spoke about in the fourth parak. both fourth parak and also the shiur that we talked about in terms of the Yom Tov Sheni and the like. Basically, the answer is no. Notice, if this is your minhag, not to eat something, right? You even when you are a guest at someone else's home, your minhag applies to it. Correct. Anyways, and you know, so and also in the other direction, right? Though today might be a little bit less. So a Sephardi should probably, you know, theoretically, theoretically refrain from eating kidney out in front of his Ashkenazic friend. But
I should refrain from kidney out first, but
you shouldn't, or at least do it slowly. Wouldn't you like these Rice Krispies?
No.
Okay. Anyway. Any other questions? I'll take afterwards. Thank you very much for saying it. Shirim at, you know, Rebbe will give him a korot and.